The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast, bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, listeners, and welcome to Horror Hill. I'm your narrator, Eric Peabody. And tonight we'll be looking at two stories, bringing horror both from the skies above and the depths below. We'll crack into things with Take My Place by Nicholas Woods. This tale follows Alexander and Annie, two scientists at the forefront of research into a new source of energy. During an initial test, things don't quite go to plan, and it's up to Alexander to do everything he can to reverse the horrific effects. Closing out, we'll read The Cave by Eli Pope. Justin, John, and Chance are college roommates that are embarking on an adventure. They're going to explore Old Spanish Cave, which has been closed to tourists for years. Justin isn't feeling so great about the trip, as he and another friend experienced a tragedy in the very same cave a number of years back. Now, Justin has to figure out what's real and what's imaginary as a fresh nightmare rears its head. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Nicholas Woods, I give you Take My Place. It was 5 days before the accident, and Alexander could recall a menacing feeling in his gut that he later deduced was a warning. Whether from his body, God, or an otherworldly cautioning, something was trying to tell him where he was headed was not where he should be. But Alexander did not listen. He was riding in a military escort van, two soldiers sitting in front of him, heavily armored, expressionless faces behind masks and goggles. There were also soldiers on either side of him and Annie. Alexander peered over at her, wondering if she had the same foreboding feeling creeping through her entire body that he had. Of course, Annie did not. The woman's face held a tight smile that verged on giddiness. She glanced over at Alexander, and she gave him a pitying look. She took his hand in hers and squeezed it. Alexander could feel her wedding ring brush against his in a soft scrape of metal. "This is going to be exciting," Annie encouraged. "We're going to change the world." Alexander felt himself calm a bit. Perhaps they could do this as long as they were in it together. Alexander squeezed Annie's hand and felt her heartbeat through her palm. He closed his eyes and took a deep breath, focusing on Annie's pulse and the way her hand caressed his. He would know her touch anywhere, and he began to relax momentarily. They arrived at the laboratory, except it was unlike any scientific institution Alexander had ever seen. A three-story modern house sat perched on the edge of a grassy cliff overlooking the North Sea. Coming out of the roof was a near-translucent wire Alexander had difficulty viewing. It rose into the sky as far as the eye could see, though he knew it extended much further than that. His eyes scanned the green expanse that met dark waters. Alexander was eager to see the history-rich Scottish countryside, but upon arrival at their destination, he discovered none of his predispositions were what he expected. The strangest thing was the number of military-styled guards that stalked the perimeter of the tall fence that enclosed the building. Alexander gritted his teeth as the van moved inside the fence. He did not like guns, especially the massive assault rifles every guard held tightly. But it is what it is. Annie's research was important, not just to the scientific community, but to the entire world, because it had the potential to harness an entirely new energy source. When information becomes that valuable, people will do anything to take it, so those invested have to protect it. Still, he did not like seeing all the guns. The car parked and the van's doors opened to a man in his 50s, a heavy coat pulled over his well-tailored gray suit. Alexander had met Burke only once over the phone. "You've made it! Fantastic, fantastic! Come on out of that van and breathe in this fresh Highland air," Burke said enthusiastically, waving them forward. The man was from the States, like Alexander and Annie. Alexander had never received a full answer for why the operation occurred in Scotland, but here they were, and it was time to get down to work. Annie hopped out of the van and embraced Burke. "Wow, look at this. You delivered, Burke. Except, what's with all the military?" Burke took Annie's arm in his and led her toward the front door of the building. "Not military, Annie, my dear. Privately hired security. No Uncle Sam involved here, at least not directly, which is what we need to achieve our goals. But we can't take any risks. Several other countries are trying to achieve what we're doing here. We have to be prepared for anything." Alexander could see Annie nod, but she turned inward, and he could tell she was also growing nervous. There was a lot of pressure on her to succeed before anyone else in the world did. Burke led Annie and Alexander through the heavy metal front doors into an interior they never expected. The place looked like a beautiful log cabin with great mahogany timbers for every banister and support beam in sight. Before Alexander could even set his bag down, a woman, well into her 50s, approached them. Burke turned, making the introduction. "Annie, Alexander, this is Dr. Minosha. She knows the tech that'll allow you to work with the space station. We've got two great pilots up there, and you'll meet them shortly. But before I go, we need to discuss something quite serious." Burke's voice lost its jovial, host-like tone and instead grew quite serious. "Here's the timeline. The investor meeting is in 1 week. I know that isn't a lot, but it's all we have, as it literally costs us millions per second to run this operation. So, in 7 days, we need to have something to show them. If we do, Annie, you'll get to research as long as you want with every resource available. And if we don't, well, that's it. Operation over. Do we all understand?" Dr. Minosha acknowledged him seriously. Annie looked at Alexander. This time, she sought from him some silent encouragement. Alexander gave her a small smile. Annie nodded, turning. "We can do this." And that was it. It was time to get to work. Burke left, and Dr. Minosha brought them to the second floor, which looked entirely different from the ground floor. This level was a fully equipped research station with everything Annie had requested to aid her work. Dr. Minosha led them into a communication room with a massive computer panel and several screens. The doctor turned everything on, and two of the screens showed video footage of what seemed to be the space station's interior. She tapped the microphone and spoke into it. "Tom, are you there? Rose? Come in," Dr. Minosha asked. After a moment, a man and a woman in their 40s appeared on screen, dressed in simple blue jumpers. "We're here, Dr. Minosha. I see your teammates have arrived," Tom said, waving. Alexander was momentarily confused, unsure how they were being seen, until Dr. Minosha pointed to a camera above the computer system. He and Annie waved back and introduced themselves. "So, Annie, do us a favor and explain what we're doing here, because we still aren't exactly sure, despite reading your notes about 50 times," Rose admitted shyly. "It's still going over our heads." Annie sat down at one of the chairs and acquainted herself with the computer controls as she spoke. "Well, in ways, it's all very simple. The clear wire coming out of our facility here that connects all the way to you guys is called a particle coil. It will help us transfer energy from your station to ours."
"And this energy," Tom said curiously, "where is it?"
Annie smiled. "Well, Tom, it's all around you, there in space." Tom and Rose looked confused, each waiting for Annie to continue explaining. Annie sighed, wiping any lasting travel fatigue from her face.
"Well, we have 7 days. Might as well start now."
Annie looked at the screens and found the station's external camera, which showed Earth sitting in open space. Annie pointed to it.
"Camera 5T. I sent you all an AHF with exact Lumos color coordinates. Did you receive that?"
"Hold on,"
Tom said, looking at a digital pad in his hands and swiping.
"Yeah, I have it here."
"What's an AHF exactly?" Rose asked. "Sorry, we just control the station. This type of work is new to us, so the more you explain, the better we can assist you."
Annie exhaled, seemingly annoyed that Tom and Rose hadn't read through her notes and acquainted themselves with her research better. Alexander silently agreed, but couldn't blame them, as Annie's notes were nearly 600 pages long. Annie took a breath.
"An AHF is an Andros Hawkes filter. It's a specific color filter to help detect certain light. Light has millions upon millions of wave variations. Some types of light are obvious, in a sense, but many waves of light remain hidden. And that's what we've discovered, Alexander and I, and what we will all harness together. Add the filter to camera 5T and you'll see for yourself."
Tom typed at the computer, and Rose read off the 50 or so numbers that were the coordinates on the color map. Once they were entered, Tom looked up.
"Okay, here we go,"
Tom said, then pressed a button. Suddenly, the screen in the corner of the room changed, and an almost purplish filter was added to it. Dr. Minosha gasped. Alexander felt himself take a deep breath, although he had already seen this wonder several times. The camera showed Earth still sitting, beautiful and blue, spinning in the dark void of space. But around it appeared a massive halo of light, a stream of golden white spiraling around the planet in a perfect ring. From their view, Earth looked similar to Saturn, except Saturn's rings were made of rocks. This ring was made entirely of light and spun right before their eyes.
"How did you discover this?"
Tom asked incredulously, looking between the camera and the window next to him, which showed open space and a ringless Earth.
"A lot of luck and a lot of long nights with some very smart people,"
Annie said, looking at Alexander. Alexander knew she was being modest, as all of this research and discovery was Annie's doing. Alexander had just been lucky to float near her orbit at the right time. And then they had fallen for one another, their love fueled by discovery and the hope that they could change the world for the better. They were the best days of his life. At that moment, Alexander felt all his remaining anxieties melt away. Annie's eyes narrowed in fierce determination.
"All right, team, we have 7 days to show the investors something incredible, so let's do it."
And that was it. They were off to the races.
Alexander's job during the first 2 days was to prepare the energy seals, three large translucent vats connected to the particle coil. They needed to be spotless, airtight, and ready to go for when the team would attempt their first energy transfer. Annie worked with the space station team to identify the energy they would later attempt to harness. The unique thing about this energy swirling inside the ring is that it seems to be comprised of small clusters that make up the total ring, Annie explained one morning to a tired-looking Tom and Rose.
Let me guess, Rose said, yawning. You have a way to track the identities of these specific energy clusters.
Annie looked like she fought the urge to snap at her.
Yes, I do. It's all in the notes, Rose.
At the end of each day, Alexander looked at the camera, which showed the ring of light around Earth. The energy swirl contrasted brilliantly with the blackness of space, a beacon of hope in the dark, lonely void. Alexander stared at the flowing light and knew for sure that there was more to this world than just a brief mortal life that began and ended on this planet. In the ring of light awaited knowledge, truth, and most importantly, answers. The team was 5 days into their experiment now, and Annie felt exceptionally good about their progress. The night before, she could barely contain her excitement.
And the equipment is flawless, so much better than the crap we were working with at Caltech.
Alexander watched her pace around the bed. He loved seeing her like this, full of pure and unfiltered life. Her face was flush, and her eyes had small dark circles underneath, but her aura burned brightly from within, and it was infectious. Alexander could have listened to her all night, but he knew they both desperately needed sleep. Tomorrow would be a big day.
This is it, Alex. Something special that we're going to leave behind. Something special for when we're gone, Annie said.
Alexander teased her. Where do you think we go when we leave this Earth?
Oh, come on, you know what I believe. We die. That's it. There's nothing else, no afterlife, no next place. I know that's what you believe, too, deep down. Any real person of science has to.
Alexander wanted to disagree with her, but didn't want to deflate her mood, so he kept quiet. Of course, her suggestion made the most sense, given scientific understanding, but Alexander always had a feeling that there was more to this life than just the brief time they were allowed on Earth. He could never explain it. He just knew there had to be. The universe was far too complicated for it all to end here.
Come here, lay with me, Alexander pleaded, pulling at her wrist.
Annie gave in and sank into Alexander's arms. He could feel her entire body relax into him. I just want you to know, Alexander whispered at the top of her head. I'm so damn proud of you.
Annie looked up, her eyes full. Thank you, Alex. I'm proud of you, too.
No need to be, Alexander joked. I'm just along for the ride. Annie sat up slightly and looked into Alexander's eyes. She shook her head.
No, honey. This journey with you, that's the ride.
Alexander felt his throat tighten slightly. It meant so much to hear those words from her. He was sure she didn't know how much their weight pressed upon his heart. For someone like her to care about someone like him was more than he could express. He was a nobody, and Annie, she was special. He smiled, then kissed her, and eventually they found sleep. The morning's light came quickly, and the day had finally arrived. It was time to harness one of the energy clusters inside the ring.
All right, Tom, Rose, are you ready?
Annie said into the microphone at the communication center.
We're ready,
Tom said in the space station camera.
We have the tracker ID inputted for the specific energy cluster. It's right next to the station. Hopefully it'll be an easy transfer down to you guys.
Annie looked at Alexander.
The energy seals, are they ready?
Alexander had checked them 5 times every hour. He was sure they were all functioning, although they would only utilize the first one for this initial transfer.
They're ready. Let's do this.
Dr. Minosha sat in the background observing, a cup of warm tea in her hand. Annie looked from her to Alexander, making sure everyone was ready. When Alexander assured her they were, Annie made the call.
Initiate energy transfer,
Annie yelled out. Tom pressed a button, and almost immediately after, the lights in the entire facility began to flicker. The screen's transmissions began to short-circuit, and the bulbs on the panels began to blink off and on. Annie looked at Alexander confidently. She knew this would happen. She sat up from her chair and moved into the other room with the energy seals. One of the three seals was pulsing with electricity. Alexander grabbed Annie's arm, instinctively pulling her back. Suddenly, light began to appear. It came in at a rush, filling the seal's glass chamber with bright, burning light visible to the naked eye. The moment the light filled the seal and the transfer was complete, the entire facility seemed to return to normal. They could hear Dr. Minosha from the communication room.
Transfer's complete, Annie. How do we look?
Alexander watched as Annie stared at the glowing glass chamber with fascination.
We did it! We've done it! We've captured the energy!
She moved over to the digital reader on the side of the seal.
Alexander, look at these levels! The energy, it's massive!
Alexander looked at the reading and was astonished.
And this is just one cluster. There's a whole ring of energy surrounding the planet.
Dr. Minosha entered the room and looked at the glowing chamber.
We can see the light?
Annie nodded.
The light is interacting with our atmosphere. I wonder how it would look with the AHF filter.
Alexander looked around excitedly.
Well, there's a retractable screen that pulls down over the glass. It can be used as a dimmer, but I may have replaced it with some of our gels, just in case.
Annie looked at Alexander like she might kiss him.
Do it.
Alexander went over to the electronic panel on the side of the seal and pressed a button. He stood back as a thin screen appeared from the top of the chamber, slowly covering the glass. And like the snap of a finger, the air in the room seemed to grow cold and empty.
Oh my God!
Dr. Minosha exclaimed before they could utter the words themselves. Alexander couldn't believe his eyes. The glow from the chamber had completely disappeared behind the filter. What stood there now was incomprehensible to his eyes. The only way he could describe what he was seeing was a figure. A slightly glowing, skeletal figure stood inside the chamber. An awful feeling began to claw at Alexander's insides.
Annie, what is that? He asked nervously. I have no idea,
Annie responded, horrified. The skeletal figure inside the chamber had very clear arms, legs, and a head. The head looked around slowly as if it was watching them. Suddenly, the figure's hands went up and pounded its fists against the glass's interior. Of course, no noise sounded and no physical force pressed upon the energy seal, but the figure inside looked desperate to get out. Alexander peered over to Annie, who was stepping closer to the glass chamber.
Annie, wait,
Alexander whispered, but she didn't listen. Annie moved closer and closer to the energy seal, the skeletal figure still thrashing about inside. The figure seemed to calm slightly at Annie's approach, as if it could see her drawing near.
Annie, please,
Alexander cautioned again, but Annie didn't listen. She moved closer to the glass and raised a hand, the skeletal figure watching her. Alexander was just about to stop her. He was about to pull Annie away. He even heard Dr. Minosha say,
"Don't touch the glass. The metal in your ring, it could..."
But her words were too late. Alexander was too late. Annie reached her hand and touched the glass. Suddenly, there was an explosion of light within the chamber once more. The entire building began to shake as if an earthquake was happening right underneath them. The light inside the room grew so bright Alexander couldn't see. He heard Annie scream. He tried to find her,
his hands groping in the blinding light. But just as fast, the light vanished. The glowing subsided, and the energy seal looked just as it had, with the skeletal figure inside.
Annie!
Alexander yelled, moving to her. Annie was on the ground, shaking as if she were having a seizure. Alexander raced to her, lifting her head, and suddenly, Annie gasped a deep breath.
Take my place!
The strange words came out of her mouth in a voice he almost didn't recognize. Alexander held on to her, unsure what to do. He turned to Dr. Minosha.
Transfer the energy back. The test is over today.
Do it!
Alexander shouted, and his command finally prompted Dr. Minosha to take action. Alexander looked Annie over. Her shaking had subsided, but her eyes still stared off in the distance, and she hadn't spoken any other words. Alexander looked over his shoulder as the energy seal began to fire up the transfer back to the space station. The skeletal being inside snapped its head in all directions. If Alexander wasn't mistaken, the thing seemed scared. It was no longer acting frantic like it had before. Instead, it seemed to be trying to get his attention as it pointed to something. It was pointing to its finger. Not just any finger, it was pointing to its ring finger. Alexander could hear inside the communication room, where a frantic Dr. Minosha was trying to explain what happened to Tom and Rose, as Tom worked to initiate the energy transfer back.
The ID tracker on this cluster is different. I don't know how to explain it,
Tom yelled.
It doesn't matter. Just send it back. Send it back,
Dr. Minosha yelled. For a moment, there was calm. Alexander looked at Annie, her eyes starting to focus. As Annie's eyes landed on Alexander, they narrowed. Right then and there, Alexander knew something was wrong.
Annie?
Alexander asked fearfully.
I'm not Annie,
the woman in his arms responded. Of course it was Annie. This was Annie's body. But something had happened. Something unexplainable had taken Annie and put something else here in her place.
Where is Annie? Alexander heard himself ask. Where I was,
the woman responded.
In there and up there.
She pointed up to the sky, her eyes going wild with terror. Alexander's head whipped to the energy seal and the figure inside.
Annie?
Suddenly, the energy seal fired up. Alexander tried to yell at the communication room. He tried to scream for them to stop, that something had gone wrong, that Annie's spirit was now inside the chamber. But before he could, the seal began to glow, drawing the energy up the particle coil and back into space. In a flash, the skeletal figure inside the chamber was gone. Alexander moved into the communications room.
Bring it back! Bring that energy back!
What are you talking about?
Dr. Minosha demanded.
That energy, I don't know how to explain it, but Annie, she's not herself. Something happened to her. Something switched with her. You have to come see,
Alexander said frantically as he pulled Dr. Minosha into the other room. But as they moved inside, Annie was no longer on the floor.
Where?
Alexander said, looking around. They moved down the stairs quickly, seeing the front door was open.
Oh, no,
Alexander whispered. Alexander and Dr. Minosha moved outside, stepping right into a scene of pure horror. At the bottom of the porch steps was one of the guards, a knife sticking out of his neck. Blood rushed out of his jugular, the man moments from death. Alexander looked at the fence, where he saw Annie, to his pure terror. At least, it was Annie's body, possessed by some other spirit, ghost, or soul in a way he could barely comprehend. Annie had a gun in her hand, demanding that the guards stay back as she attempted to move out of the gate. The guards pointed their rifles, shouting for Annie to lower her gun. Alexander yelled to Annie,
Wait!
Please, come back. We can help you.
Annie peered over at Alexander, giving him a look that told him she wasn't returning. Wherever she had come from, she was never going there again. Annie turned and fired the gun at the guards, striking two. She tried to run through the gate, heading for the forest in the distance, but other guards appeared, firing at her. Annie ran fast, but she couldn't outrun the bullets that struck her in every direction. Alexander watched as the love of his life was gunned down in the middle of a grassy field, unable to do anything about it. Later, the guards locked Alexander and Dr. Minosha inside the facility until Burke could arrive and assess the mess that had been created. Dr. Minosha was a nervous wreck. Alexander didn't know what to tell her. All he knew was he could not give up. Annie's body may have been torn to shreds, but her soul, her aura that burned so bright as it tried to help this cruel world, was out there, somewhere in the ring of energy. He couldn't put her back in her body, but he could save her from wherever she was. It was late at night, and they worked in secret. Tom looked into the camera on the space station. "Are you ready, Alexander?" "I'm ready," he said confidently. "Running tracking ID. Initiating transfer now." And just like that, the facility began to shake once more. Alexander moved inside the room with the energy seals. The same one lit up brightly before the power in the room began to settle. He heard the pounding of fists upon metal. The guards were downstairs trying to break past their own locks and stop them from their work. Alexander had just enough time. The vat began to glow, and then the skeletal figure appeared. And there she was, his Annie. He couldn't explain how he knew, but deep in his heart, perhaps in his own spirit, he knew. He would always know her. The skeletal figure looked around, confused momentarily, before its head turned in Alexander's direction. The banging downstairs grew louder as the door began to splinter off its hinges. Metal doors hit the ground, and footsteps pounded quickly up the stairs. Alexander moved up to the chamber and lifted his hand, his wedding ring around his finger. The guards moved down the hall, seconds away from reaching him. It didn't matter. Alexander touched his hand to the glass, whispering to her, "Take my place." You've been listening to Take My Place by Nicholas Woods. And now, listeners, to close out our evening, I present The Cave by Eli Pope. Okay, first off, I don't consider myself a pussy. John and Chance can say what they want, but just because I think caves are a stupid thing to climb into and that they are all, every last one of them, portals that lead to hell, does not make me a pussy. There are plenty of holes I have no fear of or problem with. Donut holes, swimming holes, and, well, to name a few besides the obvious one, but I won't break decorum and speak that one aloud. But dark holes in the ground, with springs and belly crawling? Yeah, no. I hold less than zero interest in that activity and would rather take a tennis ball to the nuts from John McEnroe and then listen to his rant. My so-called college friends, John and Chance, however, had been painfully relentless in their pursuit of dragging me along on their spring break party plan to tempt Hades by climbing into it. At some point, a roommate just has to throw the towel in and say, "What the fuck? What real harm can come from a deep, dark, wet hole in the ground? In an area I'd already almost died in, no less. Woo-hoo. Count me in, holy spelunker Batman, and dump me in the gooey mud. I'm in." I Imagine the first thing to break a person into a story would be a little background on my college journey with John and Chance. First off, I'll start with John Frankson. After all, with his belief that he is the air everyone around him breathes, he would certainly demand it. I didn't know him until my sophomore year. I actually couldn't stand him at first. I still struggle at times. He was, he still is, one of those dicks that comes from money. Lots of it. His dad hit it big as one of the first investors in Bitcoin. I despised John's smug ass from the start, just because of that. I pictured him as Scrooge McDuck's little quacker son, rolling around in his daddy's money, swimming naked, covered in greenbacks, spilling over a huge bathtub outside the vault. I still think Bitcoin is a lavish bullshit con game, but I digress. John is the student who drives the newest Corvette, gets all the chicks he wants, but has the jankiest haircut, and, well, he's Howard Wolowitz from The Big Bang Theory, only with Raj Kutrapali's access to an endless bankroll. Maybe a little more muscular and a bit taller than Howard, but still a total nerd with a wallet bulging with crisp hundies. I guess it does occasionally pay off to be his friend, because I'll admit, I never have to buy any food or drinks if he's with us, and I occasionally get laid by one of the girls he rejects. Chance Flavid. First off, what the hell kind of a name is Flavid? It sounds like a venereal disease. It would be funny, but Chance is a fairly normal guy. He was the most ordinary and commonplace dude between the three of us, with one exception. The size of his junk. I accidentally saw it one day. It's a friggin' monster, ridiculously huge. It scares the hell out of me. I've had dreams of it being an alien life form that, of course, lives in a fucking cave and comes out hunting for normal-built mortals, like me. I thought about my plan to check out therapists when we returned from this trip. Maybe Mr. Frankson, John's rich dad, could purchase me a couple of sessions. Anyway, here we are, the three odd dudes heading out for spring break to a hidden little gem another friend, Kenny Williams, and I once found when we were teens. Old Spanish Cave. The last time I was there, my old friend and I experienced a horrible tragedy. A huge cluster of icicles clinging onto the rocky cliff overhang. I'm certain we never noticed anything above us, as we would have certainly felt a possible danger that lurked. It was a few days after a harsh Christmas freeze. We were on break from our freshman year in high school. The weather warmed enough to melt most of the snow, and we were both going nuts from being locked in over the weekend from the snow. With the temperature suddenly up in the 40s, it felt like summer, and he had just gotten his license. We took off in Kenny's car and ended up at the hidden entrance of Old Spanish Cave. We swung the iron gate open just enough to squeeze through the 1966 Oldsmobile Tornado and slowly drove down the overgrown asphalt road to the empty parking lot in front of the gift shop. We made our way down the hillside from the dilapidated gift shop structure. There was an overgrown path that winded down the rocky hillside to the trail leading to the cave's entrance. We'd been here a couple dozen times before and had explored the area thoroughly. Here's some backstory. The cave had suffered a couple of cave-ins, causing the state to close the business of touring the cave. The entrance sat back in a thick, wooded area and off a side road parallel to Missouri 160, on the outskirts of the whole Branson thing in Missouri. This was years before Branson had become what it is now. Many tourists started coming to the area, and upon their interest in the caves of the area and only having two others large enough to attract visitors, Fantastic Caverns and Marvel Cave, the landowners saw their cave as a moneymaker. I believe it was back in the late 60s when the owners were forced to close their gates to Old Spanish Cave due to the cave-ins.
The gift shop looked like it had been an abandoned party spot for local kids of the time. All the windows were broken, cabinets overturned, and graffiti on every wall. It looked more like a place where Charles Manson and his family once lived, instead of a once-thriving business. From the 10 or 20 times I'd been there, we'd never seen another soul, and luckily were never forced to face such a thing. It was a long-forgotten fortress, and we claimed it as ours. Our parents and other friends were clueless that we ever came to such a place. Kenny and I were on the path adjacent to the rocky bluff that hung over our heads. We lollygagged down the path with about 10 feet between us, scanning the surroundings and talking about how spooky the place was as we moved closer to the dark, ominous entrance set into the side of the tree-lined bluff. A sliver of black was carved into the rock, and a thin fog hovered above the spring water exiting into the light. The entire area was silent, except for whispers of light winds blowing through the tree limbs, and the faint droplets of water splashing on the rocks around us. The sun shined down on our backs, casting elongated shadows that mimicked our movements in front of us. It felt like summer in the middle of winter. It was surreal and eerie at the same time. I'll admit, I felt as if we were being watched by someone, or something, from the moment we arrived that day. It was almost dreamlike, but teetering on the edge of becoming a nightmare. I'll never forget the instant an earth-shattering bang snatched my attention from the serene walk, as bits of shiny, glistening shards of what looked like glass scattered between my feet, when I abruptly stopped and attempted to see exactly what in the hell had just happened. Frozen particles of ice skidded around us, instantly filling the trail between Kenny and me. His face was stark white, his eyes open so wide I could see the white surrounding his blue iris. He stood speechless and poised to run, having seen the explosion in front of him, the one I'd never seen coming. He looked like he'd just seen a ghost. The heat from the sun on what would normally be a frigid time of year had thawed the ice enough to give way to the weighted bundle of frozen spears clinging above us, hanging on until letting go and attacking like soldiers protecting their land. The attackers had fortunately crashed dead center between us, as if they were giving us a warning to get out because we trespassed. Kenny's and my eyes locked in tightly together as the reality of what just happened simultaneously caused us to lift our gaze skyward, where we saw cluster after cluster of frozen, sharp-spiked bombs clinging to the ledge above our heads and looking down along the entire pathway on which we stood. Water droplets spilled from above in tiny warnings of what would soon be a sort of carpet bombing our entire path in or out. There was no exiting the path, as it ended in a jagged, rocky ditch to our left and a frigid, flowing spring to the right. We were doomed, no matter what choice we made. I instantly made a deal internally with God. If I made it out of here without being stabbed and pounded into a bloody puddle on the ground I now stood glued to, I would never, ever return here again. Kenny and I acted as if our minds were linked by Bluetooth, which was impossible because the technology had not been invented yet. We turned and ran as fast as we could, hearing the sound of echoed explosions of shattering ice bombs pounding the path around us. I now knew what soldiers on the ground in World War II must have felt as they attempted to outrun mortar fire, assaulting them from above, lobbing explosions everywhere along their path. I've never felt more saved than in the moment when I looked above and realized I was no longer under the rock shelf releasing its attack on us. The ghosts of Old Spanish Cave had delivered their message to retreat and never return. They had given me the chance to honor my promise, but today, some 9 years later, I stood in betrayal of that promise as John and Chance stood staring down at the same pathway to the cave I swore I'd never see again. I thought I saw Kenny standing, peering up to the bluff's overhang before turning his gaze to me and then disappearing like an apparition fading into the scenery. A chill passed through my entire body from my toes up at a flashback of Kenny's body mashed into a mangled and bloody mess of flesh amongst a pile of busted up ice.
"Come on, Justin. Nothing to fear but fear itself."
"Eat shit and drown in it, John," were the first thoughts that ran through my mind. What did that spoiled bitch know about tragedy and loss anyway, other than when he lost control of his vet and parked it sideways in the ditch after knocking over 7 wooden poles with a 3/4-inch cable running through them on Dead Man's Corner at the end of his freshman year? I grinned at the thought, but as I searched the bluff high above the path we would soon be taking, knowing there would be no clinging icicles this time, my grin slid right back into concern.
"Let's get going, guys. You have your flashlights, right?"
Chance chimed in, as if he saw the possible trouble that was brewing between John and me.
"Yeah, got it. Let's go do this thing, I guess."
"Don't sound so excited, Justin,"
John snapped back with a smirk. I glimpsed over at Chance and shot him a quick, obscure eye roll. He understood my forced liking of John. John was an asshole. We both knew it, but...
"It's okay, Justin. Shrug him off. Let's enjoy a good time while we're free from school."
Chance winked.
"He'll buy us a great supper and beers after this."
He smiled. And that's what it was down to. In reality, Chance and I were nothing more than paid-for whores. Our rate from being his bitches was nothing more than food and expenses. And, of course, beers. I swore I'd leave John the Super Dick in a slimy, wet hole in the middle of this cave if I had the chance. I grinned. If I had the chance, I thought. I do have the chance, and I bet Chance would be down with leaving John's ass stuck in the dark, as long as we snagged his wallet full of those sweet hundies. Those would buy several dinners and beers. We slid and tripped down the hill before climbing over downed tree limbs and back up to the path leading to the entrance. Just like the old days with Kenny, the place was abandoned. Felt like Jurassic Park after the raptors killed everyone and took over. The only thing missing were the tropical sounds of a deserted South Pacific island. Yes, this place still brings back awful memories of apprehension, sadness, and guilt. But apprehension was the key emotion in this particular moment.
"Justin, you look nervous. Don't pussy out on us when we get to the opening. Just push in like she wants it for all it is, even if it isn't all that much. But hey, Chance, don't you go in first, big guy. There won't be anything left for us after you."
John grinned and belted out a laugh that echoed against the rocky bluff but was then swallowed up by the trees and vegetation. It wasn't but a minute later that we all stood at the entrance to the pitch-black opening.
"Hey, John. How about you tell us where we're going to eat when we finish up here? Might go a long way to tempting me to go deeper into the cave than I've ever been before. You know, show you virgin territory, since you're not accustomed to anything that's not been penetrated before."
I looked over at Chance and winked, seeing him grin before he chimed in.
"Yeah, John, the opening I'm looking at here looks almost as big as your last dates probably did."
He laughed.
"Of course, the stagnant smell of the water here probably smells better than..."
"Jealousy rears its ugly-assed face once again, boys,"
John hollered.
"And Chance, you might actually be able to fill this opening with that dinosaur bone you're harboring underneath your belt."
We all laughed. After all, John did have a valid point. At one time, I was jealous of what Chance packed in his toolbox,
But in all reality, the only woman that would let him use that tool would likely be a porn star. Our chuckles echoed back to us as we crossed the shallow spring water as it flowed out the cave's entrance in quiet escape. The air seemed thicker once we stood inside the tall, hollow entrance. It instantly felt moist with a strong, dank odor and left a mossy taste in my mouth that lingered deep in my throat with each labored breath. As we began to make our way up and over some of the fallen rubble, creating a large mountainous pile of rock from the room's ceiling, an instant dark feeling sank over me. In my head, at least I think it was just in my head, I could hear the background spine-tingling tune that gave instant chills watching the Friday the 13th movies. Shit, shit, shit. Fuck, fuck, fuck. And then it repeated over and over in the same choppy, whispered, and methodical melody. It always began just before something horrible and evil happened to one of the kids at the camp. I didn't want to be here. Memories of Kenny and my last time here began battling inside my mind as I attempted to squelch the visual of what had happened all those years ago. But I was losing. Shit, shit, shit. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Shit, shit, shit. We climbed farther up, closer to the ceiling that was now much closer to the cave's floor than even the last time I was here. More cave-ins. The space was so close now between the ceiling and where we stooped to climb that we were forced to drop down on our stomachs and belly crawl over the loose rock before squeezing between a narrow slit and into a new chamber filled with complete darkness except the beams of our flashlights dancing around the colorless blackness. We were able to squeeze through, but my clothes rubbed the shaled rock above me before sliding downwards a bit, until we were deep enough in that we could stand once again. A tiny, narrow sliver of daylight from the large opening we'd entered was now barely visible from where we stood. That glimmer of the outside world was quickly ushered to a close like stage curtains dropping between scenes, the deeper inside we ventured. I found no comfort in any of this, and suddenly felt as if I was being swallowed by a beast and trapped inside his nasty belly, never again to witness the sweet beauty of natural light from the outside. Man, this is as dark as the blackest black I've ever seen. John spoke in the most non-confrontational tone I'd ever heard from him. Listen, Chance answered. What, you hear that demon beckoning us in deeper? John asked with a snicker. Shh, you didn't hear that? Chance rebuffed. Come on, guys. This is creeping me out. It's bringing back too many memories of... I attempted to say, before my friend cut me off. Shut the hell up. I heard it again. Chance began to shine his light off to my left, along a smoothly honed wall with stalagmites shooting upward from the floor through the broken-up shards of flaked cave wall rock. A quick flicker of something flashed. I know I saw it. It almost looked like deer eyes, glowing in a red tone from the reflection of an automobile's headlights in them, dead in its tracks in the middle of the road, frozen stiff by the oncoming vehicle, as if keeping still would cause the lights to veer away. A flicker disappeared before my eyes registered to see anything. Did you guys see that? There's something over there between those stone columns. My back felt the cold chill race up my spine, bringing on the goosebumps around my neck. I aimed my light to where Chance's beam was darting from stalagmite to stalactite, searching for whatever glowed seconds earlier. John's light beam quickly joined mine and Chance's, painting a choreographed dance in and out of ours until he widened the beam of his light by twisting the lens. It suddenly lit the area as bright as daylight, and I was forced to close my eyes tightly for a moment, with that mind-numbing pain brought on by going from black to white without warning. Clenching my eyelids tightly shut, I felt safe, for a second. It was like I'd somehow removed myself from this frightening danger and was back in a world of safe retreat. Shit, shit, shit. Fuck, fuck, fuck. My heart pumped wildly, and I mentally forced my breathing to a slow and quieter pace so I could hone in and focus on the sounds surrounding me. I heard the wisp of lightly inhaled breaths I knew were not mine. They were not Chance's or John's either. They were too far apart from me on either side, and I would have heard them move closer through the clicking and scattering of gravel. A heated, moist gasp, or maybe more of a pant, floated across my neck, leaving a sour and soiled odor clinging to the air and slow to dissipate. I began to back myself up the incline behind me, but I refused to open my eyes back up, believing if I couldn't see it, it couldn't see me, and that meant I was safe. I knew it was a foolish thought, but it gave me a hint of comfort for the moment. The cave opening couldn't be all that far away. I could ease my way back up unnoticed. Should I tell John and Chance my plan of leaving? Or should I quietly vanish and leave them on their own without me? John was an asshole anyway. The question left me in a mental quandary. I remembered Kenny for a split second. Could I cut and run and leave them on their own? I wasn't sure if I could even speak to let them know my thoughts. I suspected my words would certainly come out garbled and unrecognizable. My eyelids became instantly darker for a moment, and I chanced opening them slowly. It was black again, darker than soot. Our lights had been snuffed out, but contrasted by bright silhouetted blotches in the form of blurred shadows left behind from the shock of the brightness which had attacked my pupils seconds ago from John's spotlight. I was disoriented and saw no signs of either friend anywhere. Were the roles switched now? Had those pricks left me here alone, without saying anything? Had they escaped whatever evil lurked inside these walls? Damn this cave, and my friends, for dragging me back here, I thought to myself. I searched my mind for anything to calm me. I deserved this for how I reacted the last time I'd come here. I was warned years ago not to return by whatever entity calls this place home. Why hadn't I listened, taken heed? One is not supposed to tempt fate by blindly ignoring obvious warnings. It's like spitting in the face of whatever gave me the forewarning in the first place, all those years ago.
Justin...
There were several labored breaths following the break in silence of my name.
Are you out there still?
The tone was weak, with a pleading filled with doubtful hope.
John, I called out. Keep talking. I'll come to you.
I'm stuck. Something has my foot underneath the gravel. It's tugging at me, pulling my leg deeper.
He cried in panic.
Chance!
I called out, anticipating his answer, knowing we were all still together in the darkness.
Hey, Chance!
I hollered again, but only to the sounds of silence, other than John's occasional pleas for my help. I pushed the switch on my flashlight, but nothing happened.
Hey, John, can you turn on your light? I've tried. It doesn't work. Where the hell did Chance go? Come help me, Justin. I don't know where he is. What happened, anyway?
I spoke as I dropped to the ground and began crawling, one hand moving back and forth, searching the space ahead.
It was blinding bright, and then everything went black. Did you see anything like Chance saw?
I asked as I continued moving my hand out in front, aiding my way towards him.
Keep talking, John, so I can find you. I don't know. Chance said he saw something over by the rock columns, and I turned my light to them and adjusted the beam, and... And everything just, I don't know, shut off on its own? And now Chance is missing?
John spoke in a statement doused with panicked questions.
Hurry up, Justin! I'm being pulled down into the ground! Help! If you guys are pranking me, it's time to fucking quit, John. You can call me a pussy all you like, but... it's no joke, Justin! I just want to get the fuck out of here! You can call me the pussy, I don't care! Just help me get my foot out of whatever has it! I want to get out of here and go home! I think I must be closer. Your voice sounds louder. Hurry, Justin! My leg is burning! I can't keep from slipping in much longer! I'm scared!
My hand bumped a fleshy body, and I called out,
I'm here, John. Give me your hand.
Something thumped into my head before traveling down, finding my hand and grasping hold with a death grip.
Thank God, Justin! Pull me, quick! Hurry!
I backed up, holding onto his hand tightly, pulling with all my might as I felt my legs being slid forward each time I'd gained ground moving away.
Don't let go, Justin! I got you,
I hollered out, but I felt my hand cramping and losing grip as my knees kept sliding deeper into the gravel while being pulled forward. Sharp rocks dug deep into my kneecaps, causing me to cry out in agony as my fingers slipped, letting John's slowly slip through the sweaty grip I tried to maintain.
Don't you let go, man! Don't you do it! I'm sinking deeper! Help me! Mom! Please help me, Mommy!
He cried out in terrified whimpers as his fingers slipped from my grip and my knees ceased their forward movement.
Mommy! Daddy! Help! I love you!
And then there was nothing. My hand was empty and John was suddenly gone. There was nothing left but a damp, lonely silence swallowed by the darkness. I don't know how long I sat there in the dank, black hollow of this evil world. I couldn't speak. I couldn't move. I was frozen in time. I'd stopped thinking of where Chance could have gone. I assumed he'd done what I had done all those years ago. He'd saved himself and ran. Could I blame him? No, I silently thought to myself. After a lapse of time, I had no clue how long, I wondered when I was next. Was I in the bowels of hell, awaiting consequences far from my control? The silence grew loud and encased me in its hold. No one knew we'd come here. No one. My mom and dad would never dream of me coming here again. It would be the last place they would look. My breath quickened as my mind began to grasp the idea of my dying all alone, like Kenny. Would I starve to death? Die from lack of hydration? Or would it be whatever had stolen John into the ground? Was he a meal? And would the beast below me become hungry for another? I attempted to call out one more time for possible salvation from my friend.
Chet!
But nothing other than a dry, muffled rasp left my lips. My voice had been stolen away somehow. I fought the urge to lay my head down on the cave floor, afraid the creature would reach up through the rubble and pull me in head first. I told myself to keep strong and muster the energy to search my way back out, but I was too disoriented to know which way to go. I was too afraid to stir the rock below me and allow myself to be tracked by something I was terrified of. But in the end, I couldn't fight the urge to let my head lie down. My neck muscles burned, and I was unaware of how long I'd been there. Was it minutes? Hours? Or possibly even days? My right ear slowly nestled into the cool gravel, my eyelids giving way to the pull of allowing them to close. I tried to make peace with the probability of dying a gruesome death
like John Shirley had. A voice entered my consciousness, and I wasn't aware if I was awake or dreaming. It was still black as the blackest coal when my eyes fought to crack open, and I heard a slight rumble beneath my head. Something stirring below me, pacing, planning. "You left me here, Justin," called out to me in a familiar voice I'd not heard in years. "I wasn't dead, Justin, and you left me." "Kenny?" I called out in a whisper. "Is that you, Kenny?" I had to be dreaming, but I called out again. "I thought you were dead. You'd been crushed. That icicle, it had to weigh at least a ton." "You left me, you fuck. My body was crushed, but my brain was still very much alive and swallowed in fear. You could have saved me. I was alive, damn it. And now you know what it was like." A wicked laugh echoed around me and grew in volume before melting back into silent, deadly calm. I admitted to myself with hesitancy, but he was right, if this voice or creature was really Kenny. I did leave him. I did run from my fear. I didn't know what to do. I was scared. I'd heard a voice echo through the trees and rocks telling me to get out. I saw and smelled the exhale of breath come from the opening of this cave entrance. "I'm sorry, Kenny. I was young. You surely can't blame me, can you?" I was so cold, Justin. You can't imagine what it felt like to be impaled by dozens of frigid, cold daggers, and then left by your best friend to bleed out frozen blood clots and see my organs smashed and soaked in melting ice. And all the while seeing you in my vision, running like a pussy bitch down that fucking pathway and disappearing into the distance. And you never even looked back on your best damned friend in the world. Not so much as a last glimpse to make sure I wasn't alive. The voice danced in and out between my memory of what he sounded like as a kid. It echoed between the walls and stalagmites and stalactites. This voice so familiar and yet sometimes different. Newer. More currently familiar. Like Chance's voice. "Wake up, Justin," I told myself. "Wake up and fight to get out of here. This just isn't right," my internal voice pleaded. Visual imprints of Kenny's face began to dance inside my brain. Memories and snapshots. Images of Kenny, first smiling, then morphing into an angered entity. Then I saw Chance's face, and the two renderings of my friends, Kenny from the past and Chance from the present, began to intermingle. Each face, the skin twitching and turning, stretching back and forth between the other, filled with sinister expressions, and then twisted into angered laughter. First Kenny's, then Chance's. "It's a dream. It's a god-danged dream," I told myself. "It's obvious. I can wake myself up, and I'll be home in my bed. This entire bizarre episode never happened. John and Chance will be in their beds, in their rooms, and this will all be a horrible nightmare. Just a hair-raising madness brought on by something I ate or drank. Maybe I was roofied as a cruel joke." I felt my heartbeat slow as a warm blanket of comfort began to surround my body. A warmth like Grandma's old quilt she'd give me to snuggle under as a kid. Its neatly sewn fabric squares of different pieces of cloth made into a calming coat of comfort that held a special power. The power from her love magically enabled it to vanquish all fears of the haunted terror I'd ever thought were real, but realize are merely evil attempts from the devil to control. She'd told me many times throughout my childhood about this special quilt, as she would cover my shaking body and tear-filled eyes. Relief began to fill my soul, just like back then on her recliner underneath that quilt. I instantly knew I wasn't going to die here. I wouldn't wake up in a dark cave or be eaten by some mutant monster we'd unknowingly awoken from its hibernation. A rumble entered my right ear, and I dragged my hand up to massage the soreness I suddenly felt on the skin of it. The faint sound of tumbling pebbles echoed through my head as my hand pushed through hard crumbs of stone, reaching to soothe the painful prickly tingle. Shit! The word shot from my mouth, realizing there wouldn't be gravel in my bed or under my grandma's quilt in her recliner. This was no fucking dream or nightmare at all. I was still stuck in this cave, this entrance into the bowels of hell. Hey, Justin, wake up, my friend. Chance? Yeah, it's me. Sort of. Thank God, I managed to say before continuing. I suddenly saw the light at the end of the tunnel. John is gone. I know, he answered. Where did you go, Chance? I thought we were going to be stuck here until... Who says you... I mean, we aren't still trapped? Chance questioned in an odd yet familiar voice. Shit, shit, shit. Fuck, fuck, fuck. I rolled over and began pushing myself up, pulling my knees until I was on all fours, attempting to make myself stand. There's something underneath us, something that pulled John down under the gravel floor. It was horrible. Were you here? Did you hear him or me holler out for you? Several seconds went by without an answer. Chance? Shit, shit, shit. Fuck, fuck, fuck. A faint answer came, but it came as if it were floating on the wings of a dragonfly hovering above my head. I was here. The words wisped through the air and clung in a hollow echo between us. Or where I assumed he was, as I still couldn't see anything but black. You haven't figured it out yet, have you, Justin? There was a huge movement of the stale air as I drew a large, arduous breath. It was loud, as if the entire cave sucked up the air at the same time I breathed in. It filled my lungs, yet failed to give me enough of the oxygen my body needed. I was strained and experienced a sense of being tethered in place, but without shackles. The feeling spooked me, and I was instantly confused. I attempted to draw another breath, only to relive the same unfulfilling outcome. What's going on, Chance? Are you out of breath too? I fumbled with the small backup penlight I'd kept in my pocket. As I pushed the button on the end of it, I pulled it free from the confines of my pants pocket and aimed it where I assumed Chance was standing. There was no one there. The beam, a much dimmer beam of light than my other flashlight had, faintly lit the blackness merely into a dull gray. No Chance, or even a silhouette of him, was visible as I rotated 360 degrees. Chance! I called out. I'm here, Justin. A faint snicker resonated around the small, hazy circle of the penlight's glow. I pointed it in front of me and spun again, completing another circle, seeing nothing but an emptiness, with the inability of the light to penetrate the black. My heart began to race again, my lungs once more begging for a deep intake of oxygen as my strength weakened, my legs shaking as I started to feel like I would fold in half and collapse into the gravel floor. A shadow, barely brighter than the black background, moved forward, breaking into my view enough to rob me of what little breath my lungs had just fought to steal in. My head became woozy as I battled to keep my eyes from rolling back behind my eyelids. I pushed out the only word I had the strength to muster, and it was in the form of a question.
Kenny?
I opened my eyes wider before squinting to clear the blur and see if what I was looking at was true or not. It couldn't possibly be. I'd aged several years in the time since I'd last seen Kenny, but he hadn't. As I studied him and tried to figure out what was happening, he still looked like he was 16. I think I saw the hand that held the rock breaking free from the dark gray emptiness as it raced toward the side of my head, but the lights went out once again as my body floated back down to the gravel where it was just minutes earlier. Black and silent. Is this what death is? Does it toy with your mind before it slips you from this world into the next? It's bright, and my eyes sting as if a heated sheet of metal were being held close to them. I close them back tightly. The thoughts in my head are scattered, mixed with odd, twisted visions I'm unable to comprehend, or memories, or some sort of movie reel being projected onto the inside of my brain. I want to open my eyes again, but the fear of that burning pain keeps me from doing so. It seems blinding, even though they're tightly closed. There's a feeling of internal struggle I'm constantly battling as I attempt to decipher what is real and what isn't. I experience feelings and confusion I imagine a newborn surely feels after plummeting from its mother's womb, entering this new, unimaginable, and confusing world, while still tethered to the world it came from, before that connection is snipped like a piece of rope. I have no concept of anything, just limbo between worlds, searching for answers to what I can't possibly know or understand. Confusion mixing between the two worlds I'm trapped between.
So, Doctor, Detective Blanton questioned, is the boy expected to snap out of this? We, of course, have questions that I hope he'll be able to answer. At this point, Detective, I can only make an educated guess. Justin shows no brain activity whatsoever. I don't know how his brain and body are remaining in this state of limbo. It's a medically impossible state he's in. I can't imagine him ever being able to speak. I'll confer with other specialists, but technically, the boy is dead by all standards. Not just in a vegetative state, but for all medical intents and purposes, he's dead. There's been no change since being put on the respirator. His mother refuses to have it removed. She hasn't left the hospital since he was brought in. Where was he found anyway, Detective?
An old path leading down to the mouth of Old Spanish Cave just outside Spokane. An old tourist cave closed in the 70s because of a massive cave-in. The landowner, who owns the land now, called 911 after seeing what appeared to be a couple of older teens messing around.
Where's the other young man, Detective? I imagine he could answer questions you're asking me about the traumas this one had. Or, I guess I mean has.
Haven't found him. Landowner was hesitant about describing him, other than saying he looked several years younger than Justin Abner here. He said he was crazy, but he looked a lot like the boy who was crushed by an icicle clump that melted enough to give way and drop on him several years ago. I guess he and another boy were trespassing just after Christmas. Of course, we both know that's impossible. That poor kid was a gruesome bloody mess. This boy only seems to have an abrasion on his left temple.
Detective Blanton paused, knowing he was spilling too much information to the doctor.
Doc Williams, is that abrasion enough to put this young man in the medical state he's in? Blanton asked.
Dr. Thomas Williams hesitated, rubbing his temples, and then looked the detective directly eye to eye.
"Can I level with you, detective?"
Blanton tightened his lips before his tongue slipped between them, wetting the dry, sunburned skin.
"I'd like you to do just that, Doc. Seems I can't get answers from the one I really need them from."
Blanton's eyes glanced over to the room Justin Abner and his mother were in. "In layman's terms, I can't tell you what the hell happened to this boy, or what caused the abrasion and swelling. It could be from a trip and fall, or possibly a piece of cave rock falling on him, leaving him able to exit before his body collapsed. I just can't say. I honestly don't know how to handle this entire situation with his medical condition. I mean, technically, in my opinion, he should be removed from life support. The boy is already brain dead and operating on a miracle. I don't see that miracle lasting much longer. Surely his mother will decide to pull the plug. It's goddamn tragic and enigmatic, the entire damn thing."
"Any chance at all the young man can hear us, or know anything that's going on around him?"
Blanton questioned with one last desperate attempt to try and resolve the event.
"I highly doubt it. I think he's somehow trapped between the world of the living and the world of the dead."
The doctor cleared his throat before continuing.
"And I'd appreciate it if that last statement were off the record and never quoted."
"I understand, Doc, and I won't say a word. Let me know if things miraculously change for him, okay?"
And Blanton handed Dr. Williams his card. The detective shook the doctor's hand before stepping over to the observation window and taking a last look at the young man and his distraught mother crying by his side as she stroked the fingers of his hand, clasping hers into his, and then repeating after a soft squeeze. He shook his head and said,
"A sad and vacant ending. That's not really over."
He lowered his head and turned to leave.
"Such a fucking shame,"
the detective muttered to himself as he began walking away. Dr. Williams also peered into Justin's room and watched his mother weep, before letting a wicked smile escape and spread across his face that was filled with both relief and the knowledge of justice being served. He then turned and watched the back of Detective Blanton fade into a blur down the long hallway towards the elevator. Strange feelings of victory and redemption after suffering the loss of both his son from the accident while with Justin, and soon after losing his loving wife from the grief, he quietly whispered, "Yes, such a fucking shame," before turning again to the room and listening to the sounds of the machine that held the boy in limbo between life and death make its rhythmic beep in a reminding tone that justice was somehow late, but served. You've just heard The Cave by Eli Pope. Eli Pope has enjoyed writing since his high school days, but like many other loves, kept it on the top shelf and out of sight for most of his youth. He published his first book under his given name, Stephen G. Bassett, and has published a number of other tales since. Eli lives in southwest Missouri, where the Ozark Mountains are his neighbors, and there are plenty of beautiful, twisty, and hilly roads on which he and his wife can enjoy riding their Harley Ultra Limited. And that, friends, finishes up our evening. As always, thank you for joining me, and I'd also like to thank Nicholas Woods and Eli Pope for providing tonight's stories. I'm coming back next week with another double feature that you're sure to enjoy, so I expect to see you there. Until then, listeners, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed?
Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.